The special forces had been working with falling rocks for decades. They knew how to make it look like an accident. If everything went to plan, the Oban wouldn't even know they had been attacked. To Jared's eye, there were two major flaws in the plan, both interrelated. The first was that the skip-drive sleds could not land. They wouldn't survive contact with Arist's atmosphere, and even if they did, they wouldn't be steerable once they were in it. The members of 2nd Platoon on the mission would pop out into real space on the edge of Arist's atmosphere and then perform a near-space skydive down to the surface. Members of 2nd Platoon had done it before. Sagan had done it at the Battle of Coral and was none the worse for wear. But it struck Jared as asking for trouble. The method of their arrival created the second major flaw in the plan. There was no simple way to extract the 2nd Platoon after the mission was completed. Once Bhutan was captured, the 2nd's orders were ominous. Get as far away from the science station as possible, so as not to die in the scheduled tsunami. The mission plan had thoughtfully provided a map to a nearby high point that they figured should stay dry during the deluge, and then hike into the uninhabited interior of the island to hide out for several days until special forces could send a clutch of capture pods to retrieve them. It would take more than one round of capture pod retrievals to evacuate all 24 members of the 2nd that would be on the mission, and Sagan had already informed Jared that he and she would be the last people off the planet. Jared frowned at the memory of Sagan's pronouncement. Sagan had never been a big fan of his, he knew, and he knew that was because she was aware from the start that he had been bred out of a traitor. She had known more about him than he had. Her farewell, when he was transferred to Matson, seemed sincere enough, but since he had seen her at the cemetery and been returned to her command, she had seemed genuinely angry with him, as if he actually was Bhutan. On one level, Jared could sympathize. After all, as Kynan noted, he was more like Bhutan now than he was like his older self. But on a more immediate level, Jared resented being treated like the enemy. Jared wondered darkly if the reason Sagan was having him stay behind with her was so she could take care of him without anyone knowing. Then he shook the idea out of his head. Sagan was capable of killing him, he was sure, but she wouldn't, unless he gave her a reason. Best not to give her a reason, Jared thought. Anyway, it wasn't Sagan he was worried about. It was Bhutan himself. The mission anticipated some resistance from the small Oban military presence at the science station, but none from the scientists or from Bhutan. This struck Jared as wrong. Jared had Bhutan's anger in his head and knew the intelligence of the man, even if the details of all his work remained unclear to him. Jared doubted Bhutan would go without a fight. This didn't mean Bhutan would take up arms. He emphatically wasn't a warrior. But Bhutan's weapon was his brain. It was Bhutan's brain formulating a way to betray the Colonial Union that had put them all in this position to begin with. It was a bad assumption that they would simply be able to snatch and stuff Bhutan. He almost certainly had a surprise in store. What that surprise would be, however, eluded Jared. "You hungry?" Seaborg asked Jared. "Because thinking about how insane a mission is going to be always makes me want to eat." Jared grinned. "You must be hungry a lot." "One of the benefits of being special forces," Seaborg said. "That and skipping the awkward teenage years." "Studying up on teenagers?" Jared asked. "Sure," Seaborg said. "Because if I'm lucky, I'll get to be one day." "You just said we get to skip the awkward teenage years," Jared said. "Well, when I get there, they won't be awkward," Seaborg said. "Now come on, it's lasagna tonight." They went to get something to eat. Sagan opened her eyes. "How did it go?" asked Szilard, who had been watching her as she listened in to Jared. "Dirac worried that we're underestimating Bhutan," Sagan said. "That he's planned for being attacked in some way we've missed."
"Good," Szilard said. "Because I feel the same way. That's why I want Dirac on the mission."
Arist, green and cloudy, filled Jared's vision, surprising him with its immensity. popping into existence at the bare edge of a planet's atmosphere with nothing but a carbon fiber cage around you was profoundly disturbing. Jared felt like he was going to fall, which was, of course, exactly what he was doing. Enough of this, he thought, and began disconnecting himself from his sled. Planetward, Jared located the five other members of his squad, all of whom translated before him. Sagan, Seaborg, Daniel Harvey, Anita Manley, and Vernon Wigner. He also spotted the capture pod and breathed a sigh of relief. The capture pod's mass was just short of the 5-ton mark. There was a small but real concern it would be too massive to use the mini-skip drive. All of Jared's squad had pulled themselves from their sleds and were free-floating, slowly drifting from the spidery vehicles that had brought them this far. The six of them were the forward force. Their job was to guide down the capture pod and secure a landing area for the remaining members of 2nd Platoon, who would be following quickly behind. The island Bhutan was on was carpeted with a thick tropical forest, which made any landing difficult. Sagan had chosen a small meadowed area about 15 clicks from the science station to land at. "Keep dispersed," Sagan said to her squad. "We'll regroup when we get through the worst of the atmosphere. Radio silence until you hear from me." Jared maneuvered himself to look at a wrist and drank it in until his brain pal, sensing the first tenuous effects of the atmosphere, wrapped him in a protective sphere of nanobots that flowed from a pack on his back and secured him in the middle to keep him from making contact with the sphere and crisping himself where they intersected. The inside of the sphere let in no light. Jared was suspended in a small, dark, private universe. Left to his own thoughts, Jared returned to the Oban, the implacable and fascinating race whose company Bhutan kept. The Colonial Union's records of the Oban went all the way back to the beginning of the Union, when a discussion over who owned a planet the human settlers had named Casablanca ended with the settlers removed with horrifying efficiency, and the colonial forces charged with taking back the planet likewise utterly routed. The Oban wouldn't surrender and would not take prisoners. Once they decided they wanted something, they kept coming at it until they had it. Get in their way enough, and they would decide it was in their interest to remove you permanently. The Ayla, who had fashioned the diamond dome of the General's Mess at Phoenix, were not the first race the Oban had methodically wiped out, nor the last. The one saving grace about the Oban was that they were not particularly acquisitive as starfaring races went. The Colonial Union would start 10 colonies in the time it took the Oban to start one, and while the Oban were not shy about taking a planet held by another race when it suited them, it didn't suit them all that often. Omaa had been the first planet since Casablanca that the Oban had taken from humans, and even then it appeared that it was more of a case of opportunism, taking it from the Array, who presumably had fought to get it from the humans, than genuine expansion. The Oban reluctance to unnecessarily expand the race's holdings was one of the primary reasons the CDF suspected someone else had initiated the attack. If, as was suspected, it had been the Array who attacked Omaa and then managed to keep it, the Colonial Union would almost certainly have retaliated and attempted to take back the colony. The other interesting thing about the Oban, which made their putative alliance with the Array and the Enisha so puzzling to Jared, was that in general, unless you were in their way or trying to get into their face, the Oban were utterly uninterested in other intelligent races. They kept no embassies, nor had official communication with other races. As far as the Colonial Union was aware, never once did the Oban ever formally declare war or sign a treaty with any other race. If you were at war with the Oban, you knew it because they were shooting at you. If you weren't at war with them, they had no communication with you at all. The Oban were not xenophobes. That would imply they hated other races. They simply didn't care about them. That the Oban, of all races, would align with not one but two other races was extraordinary. That they would align against the Colonial Union was ominous. Underneath all of the data about Oban's relations, or lack thereof, with other intelligent races, was a rumor about the race that the CDF did not give much credence to, but noted due to its widespread belief among other races. The Oban did not evolve intelligence, but were given it by another race. The CDF discounted the rumor because the idea that any of the fiercely competitive races in this part of the galaxy would take the time to uplift some rock-banging underachievers was unlikely to the point of ridiculousness. The CDF knew of races who had exterminated the near-intelligent creatures they had discovered on the real estate they wanted, on the grounds that it was never too early to eliminate a competitor. It had known of none that did the opposite. If the rumor were true, it would rather strongly imply that the intelligent designers of the Oban were the Khonsu, the only species in the local neighborhood with the high-end technological means to attempt a species-wide uplift, and also the philosophical motive, given that the Khonsu's racial mission was to bring all other intelligent species in the area into a state of perfection, i.e., like the Khonsu. The problem with that theory was that the Khonsu's method of bringing other races closer to Khonsu-like perfection usually involved forcing some poor hapless race to fight them, or pitting one lesser race against another, as the Khonsu did when they matched humans against the Array for the Battle of Coral. Even the species most likely to have created another intelligent species was more likely to destroy one instead, directly or indirectly. The race, a victim of not meeting the Khonsu's high and inscrutable standards. The Khonsu's high and inscrutable standards were the primary argument against the Khonsu creating the Oban, because the Oban, unique among all intelligent races, had almost no culture to speak of. What few xenographical studies of the Oban had been done by humans or other races discovered that aside from a spare and utilitarian language and a facility for practical technology, the Oban produced nothing of creative note. No significant art across any of their perceivable senses, no literature, no religion or philosophy that xenographers could recognize as such. The Oban barely even had politics, which was unheard of. The Oban society was so bereft of culture that one researcher contributing to the CDF file on the Oban suggested quite seriously that it was an open question whether Oban performed casual conversation, or indeed were even capable of it. Jared was no expert on the Khonsu, but it seemed unlikely to him that a people so concerned with the ineffable and eschatological would create a people incapable of concerning themselves with either. If the Oban were what happened with intelligent design, it was an affirming argument for the value of evolution. The sphere of nanobots surrounding Jared flung away and behind. He blinked furiously in the light until his eyes adjusted, and then sensed around for his squad. Tight beams found him and highlighted the others, their bodies almost invisible thanks to their input-sensitive unitards. Even the capture pod was camoed. Jared floated toward the capture pod to check its status, but was warned away from it by Sagan, who checked it herself. Jared and the rest of the squad grouped closer together, but not so close they would get in each other's way when they deployed their chutes. The squad deployed chutes at the lowest possible height. Even camouflaged, parachutes could be seen by an eye that knew what to look for. The capture pod's parachute was immense and designed to support dramatic air braking. It made impressive snapping sounds as the nanobot-created canopy formed, filled with air, and then violently tore apart, only to form again a second later. Finally, the capture pod slowed enough that its parachute held. Jared turned to the science station, several clicks to the south, and upped the magnification on his cowl to see if there was any movement at the science station that would suggest they had been seen. He saw nothing and had his observation confirmed by Wigner and Harvey. Moments later, they were all on the ground, grunting as they moved the capture pod past the edge of the meadow and into the woods, and then moving quickly to augment its camouflage with foliage.
"Everyone remember where we parked,"
Seaborg said. "Quiet," Sagan said, and appeared to be focusing on something internal. "That was Rentgen," she said. "The others are getting ready to deploy chutes." She hoisted her MP.
"Come on, let's make sure there aren't any surprises."
Jared felt a peculiar sensation, like his brain being picked.
Oh, shit,
Jared said. Sagan turned to look at him. What? She said.
We're in trouble,
Jared said. And halfway through saying it, Jared felt his integration with his squad violently cut off. He gasped and clutched his head, overwhelmed by the feeling of having one of his major senses ripped out of his skull. Around him, Jared saw and heard the other squad members collapsing, crying out and vomiting from the pain and disorientation. He fell to his knees and tried to breathe. He retched.